This is Infidel One. Offending Coyote Down. Offending Coyote Down.
Roger that.
Welcome to Trappin' Radio. We're proud, organic, free-range, wild fur farmers of North America.
Let me tell you a little story about how I was raised. Every day work, every day pray. God, family, friends, yeah, everybody sins. A winner never quits, and a quitter never wins. Help folks in need, don't fall for greed. A jealous man is weak, so think before you speak. If you love them, let them know. If you hate, let it go. Fast can be fun, but sometimes you need slow. God is all good, the devil is so real. So listen up, y'all, cause this is how I feel.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got none. Except for the good Lord up above. I answer to no one.
Now let's cover our sponsors. They do a lot to help support Trappin' Radio. So I'm asking you guys out there and gals to help support our sponsors as they keep Trappin' Radio on the air. First sponsors, Oki Cable and Trap Supply. Jeb's the owner of this. He's out of Oklahoma. Super guy. You'll not meet anybody nicer. It's somebody you're going to want to deal with. You can reach him at oktrapsupply.com. You can give Jeb a call at 918-429-4648. Not only does he do trap supply guys, he's a fur buyer, so if you're around the Oklahoma or surrounding states, give him a call with your fur. When you need stuff, give him a call and he'll get it out to you as soon as he can. Our second sponsor is F&T Fur Harvesters Trading Post. Everything you need for trapping, hunting with hounds, and predator calling. Guys, if you're into trapping fur, hunting fur, chasing fur with dogs, you're not going to be able to think of hardly anything that you can't get from F&T. You can reach them at fntpost.com. You can also give them a call at 989-727-8727. Whatever you want, F&T's got it. Wildlife Control Supplies, proven solutions for wildlife control, delivering value, expertise, and products to the wildlife individual. If you're in the ADC business, control business, even fur trapping, you need to look at these guys' website. Top-notch company, have everything you would want, even the odd stuff that ADC guys are looking for. You can reach them at wildlifecontrolsupplies.com. You can give them a call at 877-684-7262. International number is 860-844-0101. If you're a wildlife control professional, you need to have Wildlife Control Supplies as one of your favorites on your computer or your phone, because when you come across something that you need specialized equipment, Alan will get it right out to you. Now let's go trapping.
See, I'm a flag flying, Bible toting son of a gun. Yeah, I'm hell on the heart, just a rebel on the run. Scared, don't know it, fear, don't feel it. The truth is the light, sometimes you gotta fight. Good beats bad, right beats wrong. I'm a barroom preacher and this is my song. I'm climbing for the top, representing for the country. I'm the people's champ, right out to dead camp. Shotgun toter, Republican voter. Hank Jr. supporter, let's protect our border. To hell with anyone who don't believe in the USA. Cause this is what I say.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got.
Welcome to Trapping Across America. This is your host, Clint Locklear. We're going to be talking about a lot of different things today, all pertaining to trapping. And I just have to give everybody a fair warning. Daisy, my lifelong trapping dog that's too old to do much trapping anymore, she's kind of confused when I do these shows because we have a routine where I get up early, I print off orders, and then I go pack those as fast as I can so I can go out and do what I'm supposed to be doing this time of year. But it's like 4 degrees. Now, you guys up north may be laughing at that, but 4 degrees to someone in Tennessee is cold. And what I'm worried about is Daisy doesn't understand why I'm not doing our normal routine right now because I'm doing the radio show. And she goes outside, and in about 30 seconds, she realizes it's a little colder than it looks, even though it's sunshine. And so I may be getting up a few times, let her in and out, or she'll sit there and scratch the door and make all kind of medicine. But, I mean, kind of racket for us. But I want to go over some things, and then I want to get back on the snaring, because I didn't get in the snare support part a lot on the last show when I was talking about the coyote snaring, because I think that's one of the most important things. And but I have some questions and stuff that's been given to me that I thought would be interesting to go over. But before I do that, there's some emails that I got, and I'm going to try on this first one. There's no way in the world you're going to be able to remember this to try to help the New York trappers out. So what I'm going to have to do is I'm going to put this link down on the show notes before the sponsor. So if you want to call in and try to help them out in New York, you can do that. Because what it is, it's a survey, and I don't quite understand some of these abbreviations, but I got this from the New York Trapping Forum. And it says, please take the time to send your constructive comments to the DNC. Now, I don't know what that means exactly, but I'm sure it's their Department of, I don't know what the E and C, I'm thinking Education and Corrections, but that wouldn't have anything to do with Fisher. So, to the DNC on the plan, this is important, and even if you don't have Fisher in your area now, this plan will guide the future management of Fisher for the next 10 years here in New York. Comments will be accepted until March 21st, so please take 15 minutes to let the DNC know that you want to be able to trap trappers. And this is from the New York Trapping Association, I assume, that I've got. And it's a long freaking URL. I mean, it's www.dec.ny.gov/document/wildlife_pdf/draft-new-york-fisher-management-plan.pdf. So there's no way you can do that. And if you're not from New York, you know, let's use our head here, guys. Even if you're not from New York, just pick a city. And say you are, and say, well, you know, trapping's killing your squirrels, your dogs, your cats, and rape your mother if you have to. But try to help these guys get Fisher up there, because Fisher populations explode. And Fisher, a lot of times, is really good money for some guys when they don't have maybe some other fur that they can get. And this is just something, this is a way that trappers can help each other out. So I'm going to put this link down before the sponsor, so you can click on it and you can go in there and try to help those guys out. Now, another one that I just found was interesting, because this is a small niche that I don't think a lot of trappers have really thought about. And without being online and doing some of the different things we've talked about for gaining business, I'm not sure exactly what you could do, but you could give your name to the manager at the, like, your local Tractor Supply if they sell chickens like I do, or if you have a co-op that sells chickens, you could give your name to them and just let them know if any of their customers are having problems and they need some help, just to give you a call. And the reason I'm saying this is, if you go to the Bangor Daily News, and you just Google that, and then you put in bobcat breaks into a chicken coop, you'll come across a little video. It shows a bobcat. It's not showing them in there killing chickens or anything. But it's, you know, the words they use on this is kind of funny. You know, it's serial killer caught on camera. A bobcat up there in Maine, they got a lot of snow. Bobcats are not as adapt to that type of snow as lynx are, obviously. So they start really getting creative on how they're going to eat. And they got in this family's chicken coop and pretty much just wiped them out. And it kept coming back and back and back. Now, one interesting thing to me in this article, if you go to this, is the whatever their game wardens are up there in Maine, they basically said, well, the bobcats are hungry, So leave the chickens that he's killed outside the coop. And I've got some pretty mixed emotions about that. I can tell you right now, if a bobcat gets into my girls and kills some of my chickens, I'm not going to give him the fruits of his labor. I'm just not. Being a trapper may make me think about that a little different. Don't know, but I'm not going to do that. And to me, you can train a wild animal on getting food pretty hard. I've been around some really big chicken farm places down in Louisiana where, regardless of what the USDA says, there seems to always be piles of chickens out in the woods behind these houses. And the coyote population there is so unnaturally high that it's unreasonable, because, you know, you can see them in the daytime moving around almost like house dogs. So if you give an animal like that food, you're asking for trouble, especially if you're raising livestock or chicken. But the niche to this, guys, that I want to get you to kind of think about, because you got to think about all the different people that need you. And I was just on the phone yesterday with a lady from Northern California. She came across my cat collector and stuff like that online, and she was wanting to know how to use it, you know, how to use a cage trap, how to get the bobcat. She just wants to catch the bobcat that's eating her chickens. And I get a call like that almost, I would say, once a week or maybe once every 2 weeks, year round. Another one that I get a lot of calls on are weasels and mink, where they get in chicken coops. A lot of raccoons, where you have these really chintzy chicken coops are made of just chicken wire, and a raccoon just tear that stuff apart. So, you know, all of a sudden these people have these chickens, they become fond of them, and now they go out there and it looks like, you know, North Vietnamese attacked them with gooks and the wire and all that type stuff. And it just really freaks them out, so they start looking for an answer. As a trapper, the cool thing about that, if you get creative and you talk to people that sell the chickens in your local area, or find out who the kind of the guru is that does the chickens in your area, not commercially, guys, I'm talking homeowner wise, thinking about it more for gardenings, because, you know, you have the on the ADC part of this, even if it's during the winter and it's not technically ADC where you have an ADC business, if gardeners are having trouble with groundhogs and coons, and people with chickens are having problem with bobcats and raccoons and weasels and mink and stuff like that, it's a niche thing that somebody that has a lot of creativity to figure out how to get in that market a little bit can kind of have it to their self. And backyard chickens, if you don't know this, in urban areas and cities and neighborhoods, that's becoming like one of the hottest things for soccer moms to do. Is, you know, they get two or three chickens, they're you know, it's just their way of feeding their family good food, you know, or whatever. But there's so many of them that don't really have a lot of experience when it comes to anything to do with wildlife. It could really happen. Now, if I was looking to do that, and I was around an urban population or a big suburbs, and it's legal for people to do that, or they're doing it anyway, what I would do is I would call up the local newspaper and go, hey guys, you know, I'm getting calls because people are putting chickens and quails and geese and stuff like that in their backyard, and in the summer the groundhogs are eating all their vegetables, and the moles are doing this and that. Why don't you let me write just a 300 to 400 article, you know, once a month for the newspaper for free, and I will try to help guide the homeowners so they understand some of the best ways to handle a situation like that. Now, if you do that, a newspaper is going to let you do that because it's intriguing. They know that's something they're not touching. It'll cause some controversy. But when you write an article like that, kind of think of it, if you were a 75-year-old granddad and you were kind of giving advice to a young daughter or daughter-in-law or something like that. You got to think of it more gentle. You just can't have the kill them all, let God sort them out type of mentality if you write that for a newspaper. But if you if you write that in there, if you find out where the gardening clubs are and stuff like that, ask them if you can write it, because, you know, you could talk about electric fence, you could talk about guard dogs, you could talk about the problems that they have, you could talk about the diseases, you could pull up a bunch of different articles by using the Google Analytics we talked about a couple of shows back, where, you know, raccoons have attacked people and gray fox have the, you know, the rabies and this, that, and the other. But the whole point of that is, in your localized area, where it helps you, is you become the expert that people come to. And when you become the expert that people come to, when someone has a problem, they're going to send those people to you, and you want to have more ground to trap. And a lot of times you can get some money and trap the animal. In a lot of these suburban type areas, there is a lot of fur there. So that's the reason I brought up this thing about the serial killer killing chickens in Maine. But I thought you'd find that interesting. Now, the other one is sent by Dennis. And to me, this is a very interesting article, because it brings up a lot of philosophical things about our society. But somebody was in a Louisiana market. And when you say that in Louisiana, it's a fish market. It's where you go buy perch, catfish, gar, stuff like that. And they'll have shrimp and stuff. But it's a local market, which you still have in some parts of the Deep South. And someone came across and they had raccoons in there for sale. And it kind of freaked the dude out. So he thought he was being real clever. So he took a video and sent it to the health inspector. Now, the thing that there's a few things to look at this. One, raccoon, if someone wants to eat it, it's nobody's business. That's not my favorite meat. I'd much rather eat beaver or bobcat. But, you know, I can understand if someone wants to eat it. And you can say, well, that's just for poor people. Guys are selling the raccoon meat for $9.99 a pound, which means it's going more than hamburger or cheap steaks right now. So it's not like it's a cheap meat, but it's something in areas that people just enjoy, and it's part of their culture. But this dude called the health inspector. He goes down, and sure enough, they're selling raccoons. He don't know what to do, because is it legal or is it not legal? And I would say in Louisiana, it probably is legal. Now, the USDA is probably not going to like this, because they're not making any money off of it by having paid inspectors by the people that are processing the meat to get it. So they're probably going to figure out a way to either nix it, because they're not making their money, and the USDA is just about money, or they're going to figure out a way to stop it because they're not making money. But $9.99 a pound. Which leads me to, and I'm not saying this is the right thing or the wrong thing, but y'all guys have heard me say some of my heroes are moonshiners. And I totally, absolutely mean that when I say that. Not the people themselves, but the concept of a government telling you that you cannot have alcohol because we deem it's not good for you to put in your body. And since we're your mother and you've got to do what we say, we're going to make it illegal and start chasing you around. And some of the good Scottish Appalachian American males gave them the middle finger, and they went out and they made it anyway, and they made good money. And the reason I'm saying that, if you're in an area and people want raccoons and it's $9.99 a pound, it's the way that I look at that, if you have a product that another person wants to buy and it's a quality product, that's between you and them. But just being an entrepreneur, knowing that he's paying $9.99, or the customer's paying $9.99 a pound, that probably means he bought that whole raccoon for probably $4, $5, something like that. The trapper probably was happy. And but you know, you could attend that. That's pretty freaking amazing. $9.99 a pound. Even if it was $1.99 a pound, that would mean that a 10-pound raccoon after it was gutted would be worth $20. You know, and it's a shame to me that the health inspectors are trying to figure out if it's legal or not. If somebody wants to eat wild meat, that is truly the most pure, organic, free range, all of the hell stuff people are craving right now, trappers can get for them. But if you're in an area that people need it, I might be figuring out a way to give it to them. You know, it's just a thought, you know, but the health inspectors may be getting a little upset and different things. And when you read the comments down through here, underneath this article, and this article is in, I think it's Predator Extreme, is what the article is actually in. And the title is LA Market Sells Raccoons. And this is online. I don't think this is a paid magazine by any type from all the advertising on here. So you can go to it and look at it. But go under there if you get a chance and look at some of the comments from people, because I guarantee you right now, with the political aggravation that people have with President Snow in the Capitol right now, the comments are way different than they would have been 5 or 10 or 20 years ago. And I just find that very interesting. And it gives me a little bit of hope about America, because it's not the guy that wrote the article. It's just normal people that are putting these comments in. Of course, some of them are peckerheads, but, you know, you kind of get a general gist that people are like, well, if people want to buy meat that's natural like that, they ought to be able to buy meat. And as a trapper, dude, if we can figure out how to make beaver meat where it's cool, think of how much a beaver would be worth. Because a beaver meat by itself would easily be worth more than beef, because it'd be exotic. It would if someone could do some tests on what actually was in the meat as far as omega-3s and stuff, and I guarantee you it is, because they eat a lot of plant life, because they're basically, you know, a waterborne herbivore that happens to eat hard herbs, trees. And, you know, that could really turn around trapping and things like that. This is one of those things, guys, that if we get far enough into the show, I've got something to talk about Ducks Unlimited. This is one of those things that just chaps my butt when it comes to what state and national trapping organizations ought to be doing. This is one of those things they ought to be figuring out with the money they get from trappers, and with all the money that they get out of dealers, and all the money they've got sitting in the bank account. This is what they should be doing. Figuring out a way to help trappers market a viable product, which is organic, free range, wild, high nutritious meat. And it may not be just raccoons, but it could easily be beaver and bobcat and different things like that. And working with the states and working with the getting involved with some of the people that are into more of the natural food movement, and try to get some momentum going where trappers, if you go catch a, you get 20 pounds of beaver meat, you could sell that to somebody that wants natural meat that's not done the way that it's done right now, and they know how bad the meat is and how sick it is when they eat it now. If they wanted good, healthy meat, the trapper could sell the fur, sell the caster, really get good at processing that meat the way the market wants it, and that beaver could probably easily be worth, you know, 20 pounds of beaver meat should easily be worth $100. Now, we don't look at it that way, but someone that's wanting healthy food, especially if you start looking into the paleo diet, guys, if you know people that's into CrossFit, which is a highly insane form of exercise people are doing now, but most of those are into paleo, and most of those people are paying $30 for organic, free-range, pasture-raised chickens for a chicken. Now, I love my chickens, but the chicken ain't worth $30 to me to eat it. For one, I'm not a big chicken eater. But if they could get something that would be as nutritious as a beaver or a bobcat, if some of the, like the NTA and the FTA would do something to start moving us towards this direction, because the country's ready for it, no question in my mind. Because if you take what a trapper does to meat, to something that could feed people with all the poor people and for the children and all the stuff the liberals just preach on every single day, what would that mean to trappers where they could not only supply for the fur market, but they could supply a niche market of people that want meat like that? Because I guarantee you, to someone in the paleo, that does the paleo CrossFit type diet, they would not hesitate paying $50 to $100 for 20 pounds of good processed beaver meat. Now, maybe that's something we need to think more along the lines of moonshiners. I'm not against that at all. That would be totally up to you, but I do think it's something that we as trappers, maybe we should start, you know, like really getting on the NTA and the FTA and our state organizations. How come they're not helping us do this? What are they doing with the money that's actually helping us besides the tag words and the slogans and the stuff that we always hear come election time or donation time? This is something that they could put the money we give them and the power of that, so it'll help the trappers and make the trapping market even stronger. Just my thoughts on that anyway. Okay, next on the list. Okay, this is a question. I've got about four of these in different ways in the last, I think probably about 48 hours. And like where I'm at in Tennessee, which is southern Tennessee, which you might as well say North Georgia, North Alabama, you know, we were below zero not before last. And then you got guys that go all, you know, are still trapping, and I think one of these was as high up in Michigan, and it's minus 13 or 18 or something like that. And they're concerned that their lures won't work when it's that cold. Guys, a coyote or a fox can smell a mouse under 3 foot of snow. Now, a mouse, think about the olfactory sensors that are being set off. If they can smell a mouse under 3 foot of snow, and then you put that mouse next to something like Federales or Gator Bait or Hiawatha Valley or Powder River or something like that, you set that mouse down to it, you couldn't even smell the mouse from the odors coming out of those commercial baits. It's probably 50 times stronger than that. And especially you do a lure like, you know, Boss Dog or Fox Hollow's GH2 or something like that, they're probably 100 times stronger than the mouse that the coyote or the fox can smell under 3 foot of snow. We as trappers have to understand, we're not trapping what a human would smell, we're trapping what a coyote can smell. And if you think that's a crazy analysis, think about this. A coyote can trail a deer just from it walking down a trail. They can smell that the deer was there sometimes up to a couple of days later, just from them walking with the little foot pads that's on the deer's hooves. They can smell that in extremely cold weather, way below zero. And then somehow trappers have been either trained to think this way or naturally think this way. I'm not sure what it is, that you got to have a lure that'll just take the hair, slap off your head if you crack the lid because it's cold, is ridiculous. I mean, if you logically and critically think about that, the difference between putting Federales down a hole, how much more just explosive that is compared to a deer walking on a trail, it wouldn't matter. You know, it really doesn't matter. Now, if you're somewhere that, you know, you're into regular 20, 40, 60 below, like Fairbanks, Alaska, or parts of Canada and different things like that, even with the glycerins and the different things and different ways to antifreeze baits and lures that trappers use, you may have an issue with stuff at those temperatures, 30, 40 below, maybe freezing. And when something freezes, sure, it does not let off as much molecules because they're slowed way down. But if you're in that type of environment, guys, a really simple thing to do, and it's not going to hurt anybody's bait, and it shouldn't hurt anybody's lure of anything that I can think of, especially short term, if you're in somewhere that's sure enough 20, 30, 40 below zero on a consistent basis, if you've got a pint of bait, think about putting 10 to 15% of that volume, the same for lure, get some really high quality, moonshine's the best, the first top off, it's 180 proof, Everclear if you can get it, or at the minimum 80 proof vodka. Mix about 10 to 15% into that if you're really into those cold weather. And when you mix that into that bait and cap it. Now, what that does for you when you're going out in that really extreme, and 0 degrees is not extreme for any commercial lures that are worth a dang, but when you get really cold, that vodka, what it'll do, that vodka will want to evaporate. And even when it's cold, it can evaporate a little bit. When it's 20 below zero, vodka can still evaporate, but it does that at a lot slower rate. And what it does is it evaporates, it pushes off the molecules that's in that bait or lure if you're worried about something not being able to smell it. But even at 30 below zero, like when I was in Alaska, if I were to open a frozen jar of Federales, if I'd have had it at that time, I guarantee you I could have smelled it. And I probably couldn't smell a mice if it was in my hand. So that's just something to think about. Don't get so tore up about different things when it comes to... It's almost like people get on... I don't know how to say this. They try to tear down and separate every single thing about trapping and not think about the total system to the point where they get concentrated on these little things like that, where it's not as loud if it's cold because it doesn't smell as strong to me. But see, you're not the one that the trapper's trying to catch. A coyote is, it smells probably 600 times more than you do. Well, if you can smell it and you can really ratchet that smell up times 600%, you'd probably gag. And then people will lose confidence in cold weather with lures and baits because they've read online that they've got to have skunk or they got to have this or they got to have that. And, you know, they lose confidence in theirself, and then all of a sudden stuff doesn't work right. And most of the time it's because the trapper's doing something subconsciously where he doesn't believe in the set and he doesn't put the time or the right effort, or something just doesn't work. I don't know if it's, the karma or whatever, but if a trapper doesn't have confidence, the set doesn't seem to have confidence, and then the animal doesn't have confidence in it. Excuse me. So, you know, that, wow. That's one of those things that just doesn't make logically sense, but seems to be true when you go out and you trap a lot. So, you know, about the cold lures, just keep that in mind, guys. It's not that really big of a deal. Now, before we get to the snaring part of this, and then if we have time, we're going to go into the Ducks Unlimited part of this. I had a PM on Facebook, and I'm going to read it to you. And I was hoping it would come right up. I tried to have it saved. Okay. This is from Jason Webster. I don't think he's going to care if I use his name. On a few occasions, you have asked for people to ask questions. When did you know you were personally ready to do control work professionally? Was it out of need of income? You had caught a certain number of animals, or whatever was in your mind to think that you were ready to make the leap? It's just a question. If you feel it's worth answering on the show or on another platform, I would at least like to hear your answer, even if it's a short one-liner. Well, guys, that ain't a short one-liner. And everybody's different about how they get in situations. The way that I started doing predator control for people was a little bit different than the way most people are going to go about getting into predator control. I was working for Marion County, Tennessee. And for a couple of years by this point, they were paying me for 10 months out of the year to trap beaver. And I got to know all these farmers. Well, about that same time, farmers started bringing in these little meat goats. And whatever they were doing with that. And they started showing up. And then, you know, it was about the same time that people started getting into the having some small livestock on their property and things like that with sheep. And every now and then a farmer would go out and he would have a calf killed and just tore all to pieces and this, that, and the other. Whether it was a coyote or a dog, the coyote always got blamed anyway. So I had these farmers are asking me to trap coyotes, but the county was specifically paying me for beaver. And we had a Farm Bureau meeting, and they asked me to speak at the Farm Bureau meeting. So I got up there, and I was kind of giving my thing and, you know, explaining what I did and you know, what the traps were and you know, all that type stuff. And I knew most of the people in the audience, and the county executive, which was over me technically, and then the guy that was on paper over me was our ag extension officer, was also at the Farm Bureau meeting. And one of the farmers that I knew he was going to ask this question asked me if I could trap problem coyotes for people since I was already there. Now, I personally was getting really, really bored of just trapping beaver after a couple of years. I mean, you know, it's day after day after day of trapping beaver. And you kind of want to do some different things. Well, I kind of knew he was going to ask this question. I knew all of his buddies were wanting me to trap coyotes. And I knew both of the guys that could give me permission were going to be sitting there. And I decided to put both of them in a very uncomfortable situation to get the outcome that I wanted. So when this farmer asked me if I could trap coyotes, I explained that I was paid by contract through the county to trap beaver. I said, but the county executive and the ag extension officer, if they want to expand that into trapping coyotes while I'm on your property, they're sitting right there and you can ask them. So the farmers did, right in the middle of the meeting with everybody staring at them. So one being a politician, you know what his answer was. He's like, sure, knock yourself out. That's how I got started into predator control. Now, I was already, during the winter time, at that time, catching somewhere around home just piddling 60 to 80 and a couple of times over 100 coyotes a year. I was already doing that anyway, so I was fairly confident in what I was doing. And then that led me down the road of now the farmers could call me for coyotes or for beaver, which really made my life a lot more exciting because at least it wasn't the same thing over and over again because I was having nightmares of setting in any more 330s and footholds at the time. And the coyote trapping allowed me not to have to get in the canoe or on a four-wheeler. A lot of times I could do out of the truck, and it was just more comfortable, so I was all excited about this. What I learned quickly from doing that is even though I was very confident at catching, say, an average of 70 coyotes a year just piddling around in part-time, it was extremely different when a farmer would call me and he had, you know, he spent all this money. I don't know what goats cost, but whatever it cost to build the fence and to get these goats in there and to feed them and water them and everything it takes to have livestock. When he would lose five or six in a night, then I'd get a call. It was very different when I went out and start setting traps and snares, and then 2 days later, he lost another one. The fun kind of left really quick then, and it really got me thinking that maybe this is not as this. It taught me really quick that it was not the same as fur trapping. And then, you know, that added a little bit of stress to it. I'm not telling you a lot of that because someone calls you for beaver, and most of the time, you know, you can go out very quickly with beaver and really knock the population down really hard. Now, you'll always have some aggravating ones and some ones I may have to end up shooting or something like that. But those problems can be fixed fairly quickly. But if you go to, say, 100 acres and he's got 60 acres in pasture with these little meat goats that run around and make noise and smell really delicious to a coyote, and you know, and they're jumping around. It looks like a video game out there to a coyote, I'm sure. You had coyotes that could probably smell those goats by looking at some of the deer studies and knowing that coyotes smell better than deer. Downwind, a coyote could probably smell that herd for 3 or 4 miles. So you were picking up a lot of different coyotes that were getting intrigued by this new smell and these new noises and these new little things jumping up and down that didn't look like they could really put up much of a fight. And they were bringing in coyotes from many different areas, so it was very different from going out and just catching coyotes, because, you know, when you're running a fur line and you go out and you set out 50, 60, 80 traps on 10, 15 different farms, you'll pick one, a coyote up here, then you won't have anything on a couple of farms, and you'll pick up one or two there, then you won't have anything, and you'll pick up, well, at the end of the day, you got 3, 4, 5, 6, sometimes 8 or 10 coyotes, you know, and you feel really good about it. But when you get locked into 60 acres, and you may have 5 or 6 different family groups of coyotes that are getting intrigued by this, it was very different from the beaver, and it was very frustrating for me, the trapper. Because I could go in, and especially when they put these fences in for the goats, a lot of times they were easily snareable. And then I would put footholds on the outside, on the inside. I would try to find the travel ways that the coyotes would use to, you know, to use cover to get up to the goats, and I would set those up with footholds. And I was trying to critically think my way through this situation. But it was very weird, and it was frustrating, and it was aggravating at the same time. And I'm saying all that to say this. I don't think, honestly, and I'm being totally honest, guys, I don't think anybody that goes into predator control is ready to go into predator control. I don't care if you go out and you're longlining and you can catch 500 coyotes in a year. Just the situations and the land restraint and the percentage of coyotes that you need to catch, I don't think anybody's going to be totally ready up for that. But saying that, I don't think that's not why you shouldn't start. Because the thing is, it's one of those things in life, you can't get the experience or the knowledge or the skill set until you go in and do it for a long time. Now, back when I started that, it was stressful to the point, because I had guys now that I've become friends with that were like, you know, I thought you could catch these coyotes and I lost another goat, you know, and you're kind of like kicking your foot around in the thing. Your brain's going, good grief, I've got 10 times more stuff on your property than I should. And I've got every travel way covered. How in the world am I missing some of these coyotes enough to get in there and do this? And you keep working through this process over and over and over again. It really got ratcheted up. Because let me tell you, if you're doing predator control on a deer farm and they lose 180 point deer that they're selling semen off of, and the actual value of that deer over the life of that deer could be $100,000. Now it's not just looking at a buddy or a acquaintance that you know through doing beaver trapping and a farmer. Now you're talking with somebody that they expected you to put a stop to any type of killing the moment you stepped on their property. And the reality and the perception of what a control trapper can do, there's a lot of gray area in between, especially between people that do not understand predators or the life cycles and all that. And I didn't understand coyotes when I first got started the way that I do now, because why in the world would I? I could go catch them, no problem, but to catch them in that situation, drastically different. So if you want to get into predator control, I would say go for it. But I do think you need to, I mean, I don't think there's a magic number or anything. And it's going to depend a lot on, where you're at and where you're trapping, and you're going to have to be honest with yourself and absolutely turn off the ego button that every male has and critically think about, at your skill level, if you were the landowner and someone with your skill level was going to charge you money, would you be happy with that? And I think kind of when you get to that point and you feel confident that you would like to hire you and pay you hard-earned money to do that, I think then you should start doing it. But what you do not want to do, guys, and listen to me on this, if you're going to start in predator control and you're going from fur trapping to that situation, and I'm not talking about a deer lease that this wants you to get some coyotes out of there. I'm talking about honest to goodness predator control where you're expected to get those coyote population down 70% or more, because that's what all the studies show that is what it takes to make a big difference. To get that population right there, not over a whole trap line, but right there down to that point, if you felt comfortable with you spending your money with someone with your skill level, I would say go for it, but don't oversell it. If you oversell it, you're going to have upset customers. And back when I was doing a lot of traveling for doing predator control work, and I hadn't at that time, I was just like anybody else that's getting started in it. I mean, I'd go to Missouri, then I'd come home and eat dinner, and I'd drive to North Carolina, and then I'd go to South Carolina, then I'd come home, and I'd go to Alabama, then I'd drive up to go to Kentucky. And over the years, I've kind of picked my core customers that I know that they're going to be loyal to me, and they know I'm going to be loyal to them, and they know I'm going to do everything in my power that they're going to have the fewest loss that they could get anywhere, and I've stuck with those customers. So I'm not looking for new customers anymore. I've got my customers. But if you oversell them on what you can do, you're going to have bad customers. And the reason I just told you all that traveling I did, I would no longer, it took me about 3 years to get enough common sense to figure this out. I was getting a lot of jobs in the Ozarks of Arkansas and Missouri. That is a mountain, rough terrain with not a lot of dirt and not a lot of coyotes that stayed in any type of area. So, you know, when you're going out to trap, you've got a reputation that starts building, good or bad, whether you realize it or not, especially as connected as the world is today. So I could go to southern Missouri and have a really, really happy client because the coyotes would be a little bit more concentrated. They would hang around a little bit better. There was more of them, so the landowner would see, you know, meat on the ground every day. And then I would go to Missouri, up in the Ozarks, up in there. Now, those coyotes, you know, when I got over towards Kansas City, that's a totally different story. But I'm talking like around Branson and, what's the other place over there? Draw a circle around Branson, Missouri, and look at that part of the world. You know, it's very hilly. There's not a lot of life, to be honest with you. So the coyotes had to go way, way far away to keep fed. And, you know, it's not a massive deer population. There's not hardly any squirrels or rabbits. It's just not somewhere that a coyote could stay in a 2 or 3 mile area and live. So they spread out, and they seem to have packed up more when they were hunting, unlike they would in a lot of other places. So what would happen when I'd go to one of these places in Missouri is I would go and I would set traps and I would set traps and I would set traps and I would set traps. And in a 2 week period, there may be two nights that I actually had a shot at catching one, two, or three, or four coyotes. But I'm getting paid for 2 weeks. So you're talking really, if everything went right, 2 days of catches. You know, you may pick up a straggler here and there or whatever, but when you pay somebody, you expect results. It's no different, guys, than if you buy something, if you buy a computer or a car or a tractor or clothes or a scope or anything else. If you're spending your money to get that product or service and the product or service does not give you what your expectations are, you're not going to be happy. In our everyday life, we understand that. But for some reason, trappers disconnect from that when they go trapping for money. When they go trapping for paid money, I should say. So in Missouri, I would do really well on the coyotes that were on that property at that time when I was there. I would set so much stuff. When they came through there, I would string them out. I was happy. I could see what was going on in the ground. The landowner was not happy. Because you go somewhere and charge what I was charging for 2 weeks, and you get 7 coyotes, the guy's not happy. He's wanting 40. Well, there hadn't been 40 coyotes on that property because most of them aren't that big the time you've been there. So if you caught every single coyote there, it may be 12, maybe. He's expecting 40. He's not happy. Now, the reputation that gets you more jobs, does that help or hurt you? So I made the command decision, since, you know, my business is a Clintatorship, that I no longer take jobs in that area. Not that I'm afraid to work in that area, but because I couldn't meet the expectations of the paying customer in that area because of just where it was. Southern Missouri, up towards Kansas, when you start getting in the plains areas and stuff like that, no problem. The Ozark Mountains, I don't want no part of it. I wouldn't even take the jobs if I needed the money because I knew long term it would hurt me. And I'm saying that to say this to you guys. If you're going to get into predator control and you oversell, or you have your customer, which is the guy paying you, has way more expectations of what you can physically do, you're hurting yourself to take the job. So you can't think of it from a greed mindset of, I've got him talked into paying me money, I'm just going to go do my best and he'll have to deal with it. You know, that may be true to a point, but if you're going to try to do something and think about any future, you've got to think about, can you meet the expectations of that guy to do it? Or that company to do it? If you can't, you don't need to do it. You know, then, you know, when you're getting started into this, maybe think of it more of, to get the experience that you need, maybe not think of it as just going full-blown predator control. Try to explain to the landowner that since you don't know his ground or what his actual population is or what's going to be there during the time period that you are, maybe don't charge as much money, but then explain to him that you're going to try to do him a better job than he can get from anywhere else. But you're going to have to explain to these guys that you cannot catch 40 coyotes if there's only 12 there. And most landowners don't want to hear that. They want to brag to their buddy that you caught 40 coyotes. And if you can tell that they're not going to be happy, walk away from it. It's just not worth it by any stretch of the imagination. Your reputation, you only get once. And to a lot of guys out there, when you know, I want you to think about most of the guys that you know that trap coyotes. It's probably a realistic number between 5 and 40. It's probably about the average that most people catch in America on coyotes. The first job that I ever did in Texas was on, I think it was either 1,400 or 1,200 acres. I show up at noon. The first time I've ever seen a high fence before. I wasn't set up for it the way that I am now. But I went around that perimeter because 1,400 acres with a road around a high fence and you can see the crawl unders is not a difficult job to do. So I put snares in there just like I did barbed wire and hog fence and stuff here. And then I went out, and by the time it was dark, I had about 12 or 14 sets out, and I went to bed. When I ran those traps that next morning, I had 14 dead coyotes on the ground. Now think about the national, that probably the average of coyotes that people catch, if realistically across the board, is probably 5 to 40, somewhere in there. You know, everybody says they catch, you know, 100 or whatever, but realistically. So within 24 hours, I had 14 coyotes in the ground, and I almost got fired from that job. You want to know why? Because he thought I should have had 60 or 70 by the next day. He thought that he had 1,000 coyotes on 1,400 acres, and he truly believed it. And it took a long time for me to explain. He does not have 1,000 coyotes. There's no physical way. I explained square miles. I showed him stuff from the state of Texas in the best habitat. It's about 8 to 9 coyotes per square mile. You know, there's no way he has 1,000. I probably took out a half of his coyote population within 24 hours of me being there, and he was not happy. Now, there's nothing you can do with somebody like that. But if you're going to go take a paid job with someone on property and they're expecting you to catch 20 or 30 and you get that from the beginning, you better start explaining the realities of trapping before you take his money or you start the job. Because once you start the job, it'll be just like you if you had a contractor to come in your house and it wasn't done right. And it wasn't what you asked for and everything else, you're going to be happy and you're probably not going to want to pay that contractor that's in your house. That's the way that the guy's going to look at you. So the long part of all this I've said, I don't know if there is a way that someone can be prepared for that situation. I really don't. I would start off a little bit slower. I would definitely think about local. I would look at it, or maybe for a couple of years your coyote catch would be down, but try to treat properties like it was a predator control work, even though it would probably cost you money, but it's much cheaper education than if you went and paid college. And then that way you can, if you treat it that way, you won't have the stress of the landowner looking over your back and calling you every day at 4 o'clock wanting to know what you caught. But you could see if you're ready for that or not. Because if you're stringing out traps over a big area, and say you only got to take 3 coyotes off of each property to have a really big number at the end of a time period, if you go in and you try to do predator control group and you're seeing tracks and stuff like that, and you're only catching 3 or 4 on that property, even when you're trying to catch more, that's probably a good indication that you're not ready for that yet. But there's no way, Jason, there's not going to be anything in a video or a demo or anything else. It's just experience you've got to learn the hard way. I mean, you've got to get your street smarts when you start trying to take a population of coyotes down below 70% of what it was when it's natural. And it just takes some years to do that, you know, and you know, unfortunately in our world is a microwave world, and everybody just wants a quick and simple, and I'm not saying this about you, Jason, but they want a quick and simple way or a system or something like that that they can go in and have it done really, you know, microwavable where it's instant success. But when you're dealing with doing predator control, I don't think there is such a thing. It just takes probably 3-4 years of really studying what's going on around you and really getting into what makes a coyote tick. Not what the next set is you ought to try, but what's the coyote thinking? Why is he moving where he's going? Is it different during certain times of year? Because I can tell you without a doubt it is. how does a coyote react if he's got pressure or no pressure? And how do you got to change up your stuff once they realize they're under attack? They're going to start changing their habits, and you've got to be able to go to where they're at that point. And then you'll come up with different systems. If I got a year contract, I had a system in place over years that I learned that's probably one of those things that I'll have as part of being only the co-op members will get, because that system took me a long time to get. I'm not going to give that away for free. But it's a system that I learned that if I had the three campaign contract in a year, I could almost decimate coyotes by doing that. But the only way to get to that point is through the experience. The only way to go through the experience is go out and get in it. But you've got to be very careful to protect your reputation while you're getting the experience, because if you get a crappy reputation, the way the world's connected today with Facebook and organizations and just trade shows and everything else, if you get a bad reputation, you will never in your lifetime turn it around to a good reputation. No matter if over 10 years you're totally a different person, you're totally prepared to do what you're asking them to pay you to do. If their buddy goes, yeah, well, you know, Joe over there paid him and he only caught two coyotes in 2 weeks and charged him $4,000. You know, I ain't paying him that. And then the guy that hears that, just like you look at a review on Amazon, if there's a bunch of bad reviews, you're not going to buy it either. And it's the same way when it comes to doing that. So just don't oversell it. Don't ever think about doing it unless you're willing to pay yourself for the service that you're offering. And still then, you're going to get into some trouble. I promise you that. That's just part of learning. And then you got to look at trapping from a totally different point of view, because now you're talking about square mile trapping instead of half a state trapping. And it's just the experience is the only way that I know really to get that. And if I could put that in a course, guys, I would, but there's no way to do that, because you've got to see stuff. You've got to see it during the certain seasons. You've got to see it in certain terrains. You've got to see it when they're running dogs after them. You've got to see it when there's unnatural food sources. You know, I mean, if I got in a situation on one of the places in Missouri that was a mile from a guy that processed deer, and I found out later that he was dumping all the deer guts and carcasses a mile away from where I was trapping. Did you think there was one single coyote that was going to come to where I was at when they had all that free food over there? There was nothing I could do about it, and I didn't even know about it at the time. And that was a stressful couple of weeks, let me tell you. You know, so you start learning that start asking if there's a chicken farm or there's a, because if you're dealing around chicken farms, the first 3 or 4 weeks is when they start, all the little chicks die anyway. And then if it's not one that actually does the underground compost and everything, they're going to be dumping those out in the woods. Well, now all the coyotes are going to go over there. If you're getting paid to be over here, there's not a whole lot you can do about it, but the landowner that's paying you doesn't care. He paid you for results. You've got to get results. And I think a lot of this is why a lot of guys have trouble staying in predator control, is because it's really hard to get through the learning curve to get a good reputation, so it's real easy to get jobs. You know, and but you just got to go through it, man. I like I said, I wish I could just have a magic bullet, but there's not one on that one. Okay, let me check the time. Okay, I want to finish up tonight, guys, on snare supports. We talked a lot about the snares and the cables and, you know, and the locks and all that stuff last week. I'm going to give you a story. Back when I was trapping in Marion County, there was a friend of mine who's much older than me that I didn't know when I started trapping. I just showed up. I was coming out of a beaver swamp one day, and there stood a guy, which is never a good thing to a trapper to see when he's coming out trapping. And he introduced himself, and his dad used to trap, and he was probably 55 at the time, and I was probably
30, I guess. So, that, you know, there was a difference there. But once I realized D wasn't there to try to get on to me for something or say I shouldn't be trapping or whatever, and we got to talking, we're still friends to this day. And D knew every single body in the county. And D watched me do all that beaver trapping, and then I would, you know, I was running, I was catching some coons, some coyotes, and some cats and stuff on the line, and I always gave Marion County 40 hours a week, and then my fur trapping was after that 40 hours. So if I was going to run, if it was going to take me 10 hours to run fur traps, it would be at least 50 hours or 60 hours or whatever the amount of traps I had out over that. I never would short the county because there again, reputation matters. But he saw me catching up with this other stuff. Well, when I started doing the coyote trapping for the farmers, he would go with me a lot. He loved it. I mean, he would set a few traps and things like that. And he would actually, a lot of times, because I wouldn't short the county any of their time because they were paying me, he would go run some of my stuff for me if I got really backed up. So D would go run all these things. And for a couple of years, D saw me set probably 1,500, 2,000 snares in the fences. And, you know, he saw me catch everything that walks under them things. And he would see me set trail snares and water snares and everything else. And he watched the loop size, and he knew exactly where to put them because after a while, it kind of just becomes second nature. You can almost go out to certain fields and know where the crawl unders are at after you do it long enough. And he watched me, and he watched me, and he watched me. Well, just like all things in life, that came to an end because one of the guys that was a politician's son needed a job, and they took the money they were paying me to put in a different dump site in the county, and they had to have money from somewhere, so the trapper got the boot and the son got the job. Well, I started looking for different things to do, and that's when I got more into the predator control for the deer people at that time because I had to, you know. But D still had these friends, and if I was off somewhere, D would come by and he would get snares from me. And he would go run a couple farms or something at a time, and he was probably getting close to 5860 at this time, I would say. And, you know, he was just doing it for something to do. He was retired, had a good time. I mean, how in the world, after you watch somebody set that many snares, would you not be able to do the same thing? But D was having really big troubles with coyotes and snares. And even though he watched me do it, there was one single part of the system that for some reason it didn't click in D's brain. And when I think of a snare, I think of a snare the same way that I think about a rifle. If the rifle is moving around and you're trying to hit something at 200 or 300 yards, you're not going to hit it. So if you're going to be a good marksman with a rifle, it needs to be steady, and it needs to be preferably in a position like on a table or on a tree limb or in the prone position where you can use a bag or a rucksack or a fence post or something to where that rifle is rock solid. And then when you've got your scope on your target, the only thing that moves, and it moves by itself and nothing else of the gun moves, is the trigger. So if you jerk the trigger, you may move the barrel 1/8 of an inch. Well, 1/8 of an inch over 300 yards is a miss. So you have the rifle is rock solid. And then the only thing that moves on that rifle is the trigger. And the way that I've snared, that D watched me do that all the time, I never put it in those words to him, but my snares were rock solid, and the only thing that could move on that snare was the lock, which is what I considered the trigger. And all my snares were loaded, So it was a hair trigger. So when an animal came up and his chest hit the snare loop, the snare didn't move, the trigger moved, which was the lock, and it would close around its neck. Now D was having trouble because his gun was moving. The snare was moving. He didn't understand or see the importance of having everything where it couldn't move except the lock. Now that seems pretty simple, but I guarantee you if I went with a lot of guys at snare, I would not see it set up where it's like shooting a rifle. The support wire does not need to be able to go back and forth in the wind, or if an animal touches it, it can bow over. That means your gun's moving, it's a miss. It means that the cable should be 1x19 and loaded, which I've got videos on YouTube to show you how to do that. So it's loaded. So when the animal touches it, the only thing it moves is firing, which brings up one of the important rules of snaring. One is you got to have a snare on location. Two, it's got to be dead center of the trail. And three, the loop needs to be the same angle of the trail. So if the loop is on the level, on the flat cow trail per se, the snare is straight up and down. But if the heel is on a 20% angle, the snare still has to be at the same angle of the trail. So the snare would be on a 20% angle going uphill. Because if you don't do that, the opening gets smaller as the animal tries to hit it. And if the animal's coming downhill, most of the time he's going to hit it with his chest and legs and not through his head because he's above it. And if he's coming below it, he's going to be leaning forward down. And because it's cocked on a straight angle and it's not with the trail, he's going to go under it. Or he's going to knock the snare loop down because he's going to hit it without going through the loop. So you got to be on the same level. And then the other part is it's got to be really, really stable. And that brings me to what I think is the reason a lot of guys have trouble with snares is their snare supports. You can, in really good, perfect book situations, use just baling wire and have a couple inches of it off a tree and, you know, use like a figure four or inverted S or something like that, like Newt Sterling shows in his videos. On a really small piece of wire, have it really short off of something that's really stout like a tree. And if the trail hugs that tree, you can do that and have no problems. It's not going to move. But what you see is the trail's 8 inches or 10 inches or 12 inches away from that tree. And people try to use 16 gauge wire with a coyote size loop. And they try to run that off from the tree. And you can blow on it and watch it move. Just like the rifle, it's going to be a miss. Or it's going to be a bad catch. Or it's going to get knocked down. But it's not going to be good most of the time. And it's definitely not going to be high percentage. So the farther away you get from a solid support, you've got to have bigger wire or more rigid wire to keep it rigid. You know, if you can take a piece of a baling wire, which is, 16 gauge, that you just get at Tractor Supply or Home Depot, they tie wire with. You put that 3 or 4 inches out, and it's really rigid. It's stubby. It's not moving. Run that out there about a foot and touch the end of it. It'll walk all over the place. And that's not going to help you guys when you're trying to snare. What you got to do is you got to make sure that your gun is not moving when you pull the trigger. So that got me away from tying off to trees as much. I still do it on the perfect situation, on the perfect trail with the perfect thing right next to the trail, and everything's going to work out fine. But perfect is very rarely happens in nature. I can think of a few places that I've been catching stuff off of trees like that for a long time. My snare support's been there for years. I just hook the snare on it and go. But most of the time it doesn't work that way. So what, like I talked about using the kill poles, I've got them out all over the place around here. If I'm going to go trap this section of the county, you know, every now and then someone will steal one, or a cow knock one over, or a tree will hit it during a flood or something and take it. Most time they're still there. But that, you know, half inch or 5/8 inch rebar is solid like a tree. And I'm using real number 9 wire coming off of it. And that stuff is really, really rigid. I mean, it's big and it's rigid. And you can, you know, the easiest way to do that, to keep everything rigid, is either use a metal whammy, which you've got to know your snare circumference or your cable, and the true wire circumference to get the right one. Because a lot of people say number 9, and it's some type of funky cable that or wire that comes out of China. It's really not a number 11, which you can get in the trapping industry, or number 9. It's like a metric that's almost like a 10, if that makes sense. So it doesn't really get in there really good. Then you're trying to shove in toothpicks or tape or something like that to get it to work. So you need true number 9 wire if you're going to be anything past 12 inches, in my opinion. Now, you can double up the smaller stuff. You can quadruple it. You can do all that. But, guys, that's so much work. Why would you go through that? I mean, really, why would you go through that? Because if you build or make or buy good snare supports, and let me tell you, if you're looking for a product to put on the market, snare supports are very underutilized in selling at trapping shows. And you could set up a display pretty easy on a table showing the light wire moving around this, that, and the other, and have a good snare support. If you don't know what they look like, you can go to any of my YouTube channel, Wolfer Nation, and see me using them. Freedom Brands has got a nice one. It's got a spade thing on the bottom. It's set up for coyotes and cats and stuff. They make a good one, but there's really not a lot of them being made out there. And if you're looking for something maybe to get into, that could be, you're not going to make $1 million on it, but you could, you know, pay for your convention maybe off selling these things and use it. So, you know, another thing people do a lot of times, because I don't know if it's cheapness or hard-headedness or just not thinking the process all the way through, is they will go through, especially like trying to coyote snare and cat snare, and they try to just push a stick in the ground and then put a piece of wire on top of it and hang the snare. Now, will you catch stuff that way? Absolutely. But you're going to have problems when you do that. One, if the ground's hard, now you're fighting the ground and you're burning more energy. And then you really tighten off the wire on the stick, and a certain percentage of your sticks are going to break. Or you stick it in the ground, and it's soft ground, and you get a little bit of rain, now it's wobbling all over the place. It's just not that efficient over the long term to do that. Now, it may sound sexy to go, well, all I do is go out in the woods with snares and, you know, a roll of wire, and I catch everything that walk, crawls, or flies. You may be able to, but you're going to miss as much as you catch. So I'm not sure that's the best way to go about it. Snare supports are really, really hard to beat. Now, thing with a snare support, you really only need two. You know, got the kill poles, and I'm not considering that a snare support per se, even though it is. But what I'm talking about a snare support is for beaver, otter, coons, and gray fox, and maybe red fox, you can use the same snare support. You know, it can be a single stake with a washer welded on the bottom that's totally rigid, like 1/4 inch or 5/16 inch. Then you weld a piece of number 9 wire on there and you run it up, so it's, you don't want to get it anything over higher than probably a red fox, because it's going to start getting wobbly on you, unless you're in totally red clay that'll lock that thing in place. The way that I do mine are like fence staples. They're a U. You know, they're like 3 inches tall. You make a right angle to the right, and it's 3 inches or 4 inches, and it goes down 3 or 4 inches, and I'll weld the number 9 wire on that U, and I can push it in. It's got 2 points of contact, and it doesn't wobble. And then I just take the number 9 wire off of that, and I can have it to the right height of the snare for, say, a red fox or a beaver or something like that. On cats, it starts getting iffy. So what I do with those is I've got that triangle, that staple again, and then I will put a number quarter inch or 5/16 rod welded on that going up about 12 inches. So it's still rigid in the ground. It's still rigid because it's rod. It's not wire, it's rod. And then I can weld a piece on there, say, you know, 10 or 12 inches, and all that mess stays really, really stable. And I can carry in a little pack a dozen of them, you know, unless you're truly wilderness trapping where you're leaving your truck and walking from, you know, walking across the state. You're going to go back to your four-wheeler, your boat, your canoe, your truck, and you can easily put 12 more of these things inside of a little butt pack and carry them with you. So it's not taking up a whole lot of space. But the beauty of these is I can, in pretty much any ground type, I can put it right next to the trail and step on it or tap it with a hammer and it goes in rock solid. And then by using a piece of tubing or a metal whammy, I can put the snare on the end of it. And like I said, my snares are 14 foot long. I'm just wrapping it around a bush or tree or something or a root that's within 14 feet of that thing. I've got a just think of when you do that, now if I'm going out and being a sniper, I'm doing it very efficiently for the shot. I've got some helpers with me that are carrying my shooting bench. And they get it down and they get it level and they get it in the right direction. That's my snare support. And then I put the snare on the snare support that is steady. And now only thing it can move when I set up on my rifle on my bench, which is my snare support, is the trigger. When I pull the trigger, and I can do it gently so nothing moves on the gun. That's what you're looking for. Now, what D was having problems with is even though he was sitting under fences, which is probably the easiest way to catch coyotes, he wasn't having his snare really tight because he wasn't using the number 9 wire that I was using. He was using a real small wire, or if he was doing the W, like I have my high performance snare in video, and you can see that, you can probably Google that really easy. He didn't have that in there, so the snare cable was tight in that. So when a coyote would come up and he would start touching the snare cable, the whole cable would move through his snare support. So his whole gun was moving. And he caught a few coyotes, but not near what he should have. And he comes up to me and he goes, "Clint, I'm having trouble with these snares." And I couldn't believe it. I mean, he's been around me for years seeing this. So we go out, and the first snare I go to is right on location, right size. Everything's on angle of the slope. Everything's perfect except his snare support is loose and sloppy and moves around. So we fix that one. We go to the next one. Lo and behold, it was the same way. All his snares were done that way, which is the way, honestly, most guys snare. Well, within a week, he comes back, and he slayed them. That one little bitty thing. Because it's real easy if you get in a hurry, or you don't really think about the whole system of the way things work. That's good enough. You know, yeah, it may be not as tight as it should, but it's good enough. Yeah, that's a little more wobbly than it should. That's good enough. And then all of a sudden, your catch crashes. Well, good enough, when you're dealing with animals, is hardly ever good enough if you want to be proficient and get high percentages of what you're doing. The only thing that D was doing wrong, if you want to call it wrong, is not having his snare support where it was rigid, where it couldn't move through the snare support and it couldn't sway back and forth. His gun wasn't stable when the trigger was pulled. When he fixed that one thing right there, D, till this day, is a coyote slaying machine when he goes and sets snares. That's the only difference right there. So good enough wasn't good enough. And it doesn't really matter. Actually, does matter. So when you're setting snares like this, think about that snare support or some way that you can have it where it's rock solid. It doesn't have to be a commercial snare support. I've used wooden stakes. where I have the snare support number on wire going through the wooden stakes, and my snare is secured to it. And I got that from Bernie Behringer book. I think it's called Space Age Coon Trapping. Not sure about that, but Bernie Behringer's coon book. Super way to catch bobcats, fox, and coon. I can tell you that. You can carry a bunch of them because they're wood and they're light. Especially in a canoe. I mean, that's a deadly system in a canoe. You know, but his support system was rock solid. Where most people will want to just take a piece of wire and drive down a rebar with a washer on top, and it's somewhat stable, but it's flopping all over the place, and they put it in front of the trail, and they catch some coon, because they have some success, they keep doing the same system, and the sum keeps staying in there, because it's some success, and they catch some coon, but really what they're doing is missing a whole lot of them, and it's a shame, because he's burning all that energy going out there, and money to do it, so do it right in the one time. Now, to close up, I've got two things. One of the questions that I get all the time, and this last one that came this morning on email, I see you using drags all the time. Where do I get the drags you're using? Now, he didn't say which drags he was talking about, if they were for coyotes or for coon. The Sabertooth drag that F&T makes is my design that they make. So when you see me with Sabertooth and you're wanting that style of coyote drag, that's where you get them. They can make them cheaper than I could make them, and so I just let them make them. So you get those from F&T, and they're called Sabertooth. Now, if you're talking about the coon drags that you see me where I take my FB1s or FB2s, and I've got the smaller drag, you know, it's still would probably very efficient drag for most people on fox. Like if I lived in Maryland and I was going to be set next to cover and I wanted to get the fox out of the field, but he couldn't go hardly anywhere, these little drags would probably do you very well. Because coon can't take him anywhere, and coon's a lot stronger than a fox. But those are called Sabertooth Juniors. And they're a smaller version of the Sabertooth, got really sharp points, but they've got the bracket that allows you to take the FB1 or the FB2, and if you're in a rock culvert, you can just set the drag down. You can, if you've got current, you could say put a rock on the drag, and then it's because it's got the bracket, you can slide that into that bracket, and even on solid rock or concrete, you can set those where you want to set them instead of just where you can set them, if that makes sense. So I'm not sure which one he is doing. So it's a Sabertooth or Sabertooth Junior. I hope after saying this that F&T has got those on their store. I mean, that's where I got mine from. And that's what those are. The other thing is I got a question on Facebook, and I want to finish with something on this, guys, and it is to do with snaring. I could tell that this was probably a younger man that has not done a whole lot of snaring, but he probably has for a couple of years. And what he's doing is he's running fences. He didn't say if they were high fence, which is high tensile, or high tensile horse fence, or barbed wire only, or you know, like hog panels or sheep fence or whatever, because they're all different now. They're all got to think about them a little bit differently. Well, what he's doing, he's running real short snares, just like I do for coyotes and cats, on high fences. And he's hooking that to the wire, and then he's supporting it off of that wire, and he's catching stuff. But apparently, he's getting told over and over and over again that that's wrong. You can't do that. Which brings me to the point I want to make, guys. If it's working for you, it ain't wrong. Just because the internet world says you've got to do something does not make it true. Just because the common way that people think about something does not make it true. Because situations are extremely different. I've held 400-pound hogs on that wire of fence. A coyote ain't going to ever put that much pressure on a fence like that. Now, if you go up to it and the fence has been there since 1940 and it's about rusted through, and you could probably take your pliers and in two or three swift movements break it, yeah, that's not the best thing to do at that point. Because, as in most things in life, it depends. You know, that's a permaculture phrase all the time, and it drives people crazy. Because it does depend. It depends on the strength of the wire. It depends on if it's reasonably going to hold it or not. Now, he's using short snares. And he has a little bit of fur damage every now and then. If he's on bob wire, you're going to have it. There's no way to get around it without getting into a bunch of gizmos and gadgets and slide wires and slide rods and all. And if you do that, you ain't ever going to catch very much fur because you're spending way too much time at a snare set. But, you know, he's not getting that much damage, not enough to bother him. But everybody's saying he can't do it because he's going to tear up the fur and you can't do off the wire. You got to go off to the fence post. You know, if you're not doing it that way, it's not right, and you're doing it wrong. And you know, people gang up on people for some reason on Facebook. He's catching coyotes that way. It ain't wrong. He's using a short snare, and he's getting a little bit of damage every now and then, but it's not much. It's livable. Now, the other guys are complaining about the fur damage because you're not looking at everything as a whole. You put a long enough snare cable to go to a fence post. So you may have a 4-foot snare or a 6-foot snare or something like that. You know, because most fencers are going to probably be on 12-foot centers, something like that. So you got to have at least a 6-foot snare to reach that, or a 7-foot snare to have the loop open. So you tie it to that. Is it more rigid than the cable, the wire itself? On most fences, short of high tensile, high fence, it probably is. If you're thinking of pure killing situations with choke springs and cleated cam locks and stuff like that, then you would want to go to the fence post because it depends. That's a totally different situation. But the damage you're going to get from putting a 6-foot snare on a barbed wire fence is way more than the guy that's going to get with a short snare. The cow's going to be over the top of the fence. He's going to be doing all kind of crazy things. And if you're around dogs and you're putting long snares around a fence, you're asking for trouble. So they're trying to say, and see, those they probably read somewhere or had one bad experience, and then that's kind of like the gospel, and they're the priest of the internet that go around telling people that they're doing it wrong, they got to do it this way, and they don't know what they're doing, and this, that, and the other. Guys, that's not helpful to anybody. Because you don't know the situation that this gentleman's in. I don't know the situation this gentleman's in. But if it's working for him, it's working for him. Could it be better in a different situation? Possibly. Could it be worse in a different situation? Possibly. But it can't be like tribalism on these ideas, because when you get in this tribalism, and it's more of dichotomy, which we ought to do a show on, the dichotomy of an idea, it's the same as, even though it's with trapping, it's the same as a Republican always supports a Republican regardless of how wrong they are. Or a Democrat always supports a Democrat in what they do regardless of how wrong or how right they are. It's kind of like going for a team. Or if your favorite football player ends up knocking his wife out, you try to justify that because he's on your, you know, he's on the team you like. You know, you get in crazy ideas. And it's the same thing when it comes to trapping. You have guys that will constantly, they try to line everything up as an either or. If you want to be a better trapper, learn the permaculture mindset of it depends, because it does depend. Because in the perfect situation, with the trail going up next to the hard, strong enough tree 3 inches away from it, you can use baling wire and be perfectly fine on a snare. If that works out, so it depends. Can you use baling wire? If it's an open trail with just grass, using baling wire is going to get you in trouble, because it depends if you've got something like the perfect tree next to the perfect trail at the perfect distance. It all depends. Can you tie off to a wire on a fence? It depends. Should you tie off to the fence post? It depends. What are you trying to do? If you're trying to get the cow to go up over the fence and hang itself, then you're doing it right. If you're around dogs and you're doing that system, something you need to think about. It depends. So when you're looking at or hearing or talking to someone on the internet or even me, and you have this dogma that, I mean, you plant your feet and you ball your fist and you're going to go to combat with somebody over, keep this little phrase in mind, guys. It depends. And especially in trapping, everything depends. Because where I trap and you trap is different. And where you trap and they trap is different. And everything, that's like people get all upset when they see me using CDRs. Where I'm trapping in Texas, never seen a house cat, never seen a domestic dog. When I use CDRs here, where I live, where if I go out and run 100 traps, I'm gonna be turning loose 3 or 4 dogs a day. No, why? It depends on where I'm at. Use a big trap on a smaller animal and you got him short-chained in thick brush, he's gonna hurt himself. You got open ground like I've got in Texas where I'm using those big trap on 8-footer chain. They don't hurt themselves. I get less damage out of those big traps. It depends. But people want to go to combat over these certainties that don't exist. So when you're online and you're talking or you start getting on to somebody, let that little phrase bounce around in your brain pan a little bit. It depends. Because when you start getting into the it depends type information, that's when you start getting into the good information. Because now you opened your brain up a little bit to start looking at things in a more productive manner than a no, not right, not right, not right. I've got to prove him wrong. I've got to prove him wrong. You don't want to be that way. That's childish. And it's not true, no matter what it is, for the most part. Because it always depends. Well, guys, I hope y'all have a great week. I know there's some guys out there still have open season. I know we do around here because coyotes are still open. The beaver's still open. Some of y'all getting ready to run into probably getting close to spring muskrat and beaver. So I wish everybody well. I hope everybody doesn't freeze to death in this weather we got right now. And I just hope you enjoy being out there. And always remember, guys, it depends.
You were born by Freedom One, yet held in precarious station. Set up on defense and sealed his will to guard and protect his new nation. So he resolved to defiant of all who would challenge his right to be free. With a swift sailing vessel and 10 carriage guns to hunt the world's oceans and seas. Born to go into harm's way, come all ye other high waters be damned. No lightning, no thunder, nor hurricane gale can stand in the face of his wrath. Be beneath his enemy's feet, or by power the gates cannot go. The life that rise, every last man shall shake to the core of his soul.
Zone to be from a yin to my yang to my yang to